just in case.
Hi, my name is Levi McBride. I am 20 years old. Today is Monday, December 2nd, 2019. I'm in Yuma, Arizona. The name of my interview partner is Scott Wesley Jones, as I call him, and the relationship to my partner is he's one of my closest friends in the whole, actually my closest friend in the whole world.
My name is Scott Jones. I'm 61. It's Monday, December 2nd, 2019. I'm in Yuma, Arizona. My interview partner is Levi McBride. He's a former student of mine and my close confidant. Compadre, friend.
I think we're all set to start here.
Are we recording?
Yep. I know you had some form of question, you said.
Yeah, can we drink in here? Oh, no, we can't drink. This would be so much better if we could get loaded while we're doing this.
You know what? We missed the opportunity.
Anyway.
If only work hadn't come up. We're about six deep at this point.
Attaboy.
In a perfect world.
So, what was it? I mean, I taught 6,000, I actually did the math one time, 6,100 some students. But this, like, somehow the jokes landed.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, and you know, we've kind of discussed going over, you know, things that we've talked about in the past and what we've been through and such. And I mean, just really what it was the first person in my life that I had really met that was real without question, without remorse, I guess you could say. And, you know, hearing the things that, you know, our whole life we're told all the same things by adults and over, they're cookie cutter standard quotes, and then all of a sudden I'm here with someone discussing the real world. It was the first real look at it, and they landed.
I really didn't know what else to do. I just my feeling about students were they were trying to do the same thing to get through their day that I was. You know, I just wanted to leave with a little dignity intact. And I thought part of that was telling them the truth. And, you know, I think you got to have a sense of humor, right? The thing I always figured out was it's all a joke.
Yeah.
You know, and most middle schoolers, it's all a joke. And you were a tough kid to handle for some teachers.
Oh, yeah. I mean, because I understood the joke, you know, and really kind of embraced that. Because, I mean, my whole life of going through school and such, even in the situations where I perform well and, you know, do well on tests and everything, it was never like this was it. You know, school was the meaning behind my life. It was like, you know, this is futile in the grand scheme of things. And I know that's the wrong approach, but, I mean, that was really, really how it was, especially middle school. I mean, middle school is kind of that area where, you know, in elementary school, you grow up, you're learning, you know, really becoming an individual, I guess you could say, or learning how to be an individual. High school is where the real shit starts to happen. And middle school is kind of that in-between phase of, you know, awkward boners and, you know, and bad humor. But that's, I don't know, I just never, I guess I really never put too much importance on things like that.
Well, I think you hit it, because school is an artificial construction.
Yeah.
That's a configuration that we're not built for. The idea that you're going to take 30 strangers' children away from their parents and put them in the room with other 30 other kids, put a strange adult in front of them and expect that kid to sit there for 5 to 6 hours a day.
Yeah.
That's not how our brains are evolved. You know, mm-hmm. We were hunter-gatherers that traveled in small tribes of 20 to 50 people, and there was nothing going on behind closed doors because there were no doors.
Yeah.
You know, and I think you instinctively recognize the joke, and it is a joke.
Truly. I mean, and going back to what you said about it not, you know, being an artificial construction, I mean, really, you're putting 30 kids in the same classroom that all are in the biggest phase of attention, you know, dependency in their life, where their parents, you know, that's what they require. They need that to grow and to flourish. and you put them all in one room and tell them to be quiet and listen to the teacher and maybe ask a few questions. I mean, I think really and I think it's like this for a lot of kids that act out in class, the ones that are doing the most and, you know, they're just searching for that attention. I needed it. You know, I needed something to not just be that kid who sat there and did everything. And that's why, I mean, in your class, I was, you know, wouldn't be outrageous, wouldn't be, you know, calling out crazy things. I would make jokes with you and such. But because the way you had your class structured, it wasn't where you're just sitting there, another number, you feel nothing. You know, it was a whole participation surrounded around us, kind of being in the moment. I mean, I personally, that's how I felt. I mean, and maybe it just has to do with it being art. You know, you're more involved. You're actually physically doing things. But
I think teachers make the mistake of believing it's about curriculum, because that's pounded into your head from the time you start going to college to train to be a teacher. Certainly, as you deal with administrators, it's all about content. It's all about test scores. And you essentially, especially since the Bush White House, children became numbers.
Yeah.
And they were always numbers to some degree. But at that point, it became a test score. You're a test score sitting there. And that, I mean, nobody responds to that. Or a small percentage of kids respond to that because they're being pushed at home to respond to it. And even in the face of that, most kids rebel against it. At the end of the day, you want to know that somebody cares that you're there.
Yeah.
You know, and that was my thing. It was like, just give the kid his dignity.
Yeah. I think one of a funny situation that I'll always remember was there's a teacher at Cibola, and I forget his name, but it was my senior year. We were doing this dumb standardized testing, and, you know, and so we had to go to different teachers' classrooms than we usually had. And I'm in this teacher's classroom. We do our testing, you know, and we're getting up to leave. And then as I'm walking out, you know, I just tell him thank you or whatever. And he goes, "Oh, my God, you're Levi." And I'm like, yeah, you know, thinking he's going to hear about, you know, maybe football or, I mean, basketball or Stucco or some crazy thing I did. And he goes, "Oh, you were in like the 99th percentile for the past 4 years on your reading scores." And I was like, that's the thing that made you, like, test scores are that important to you?
Wait,
they're hitting like that?
Man.
Like, I kid you not.
Wait a minute.
I kid you not. That is not.
Landed for you?
Ellenberger.
That's what you thought.
It felt like I was.
That's
that was my importance.
We haven't covered that before. We have not discussed that. Because was that your immediate reaction, or did you?
My immediate reaction was like, "Fuck yeah, I'm fucking look at this."
You know, Steve Inskeep is going to hear this, so you got to watch your language.
Hopefully, not my mom. That's all that.
Okay,
really
wait
matters.
A minute, Levi. It didn't strike you that you were in the 99th percentile of reading. Were you just aware of that?
Yeah, I mean, it was, and that's not. I'm not trying to sound cocky, or I don't mean to boast by bringing up that story, but yeah, I just thought it was weird to me that it was like he was looking at like a fucking celebrity, and I'm just a sick 17-year-old kid, and I was like, yeah,
you're forced to
do the test.
You're not an average person. I mean, you know, you didn't author that. You didn't wake up one morning and say, "I'm going to be in the 99th percentile and this clever, witty human being." You didn't. It just happened, you know, but
we're this good looking. I mean,
well, honestly, there's that.
Really, that's the least important. No.
Yeah, you're the whole package,
that's
big
what,
Brian.
Yeah, I mean,
that's all there is to it. No, man. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, whatever. What do you think about God?
What? Oh, Scott, a can of worms. I mean,
let's
it's,
get to it, man.
We've
got 45
both
minutes.
Of us,
let's do
both
this.
Both of us have had quite the experience with the big man up there. I mean, and just my big, the way, I wish I had a better answer to that. I wish I had a more concise answer.
Just roll it out.
You know, I think God is
your mom's not going to listen to this. She does not care. We are entering the gray goo of the digital age.
Kathy, if you're listening, I want you to shut off the phone. Our relationship will be destroyed.
It's like we're going to be in the Library of Congress. Yeah, I mean, well, let's find that file, shall we?
Yeah, for sure. If you're hearing this, fuck you, Trump. So I think that God is another construct of the human mind that I was forced to devote myself to for years and years to come and gave 100% of myself and got zero back. That's how I truly feel about it.
I don't know. It's a little simplistic.
It is.
Christopher, what's the guy's last name? Hitchens, I think is the name. Hutchins, something like that. He asked the question, would the world be better off if the churches were empty? I don't know that that's true. I grew up a fundamental Baptist. The Bible is a book of history. It's a book of science. All knowledge is to be found in the Bible. And that's been ingrained in me since I was 8, right? Yeah. And that stuff, I mean, when you study art, when you study the human condition, whatever that is resonates, and it resonates to this day. And I don't know that the world would be a better place if the churches were empty. There's a purpose. There's some sort of siren call. Yeah. There's it's a unifier. It's a way to denote the tribe.
It's kind of a piece of the order of things, I think. Yeah. I mean, and it's tough for us because, I mean, both of us have a problem with seeing people that are investing so much of themselves into a lie, really. I mean, a false narrative. But when overall, I mean, kind of looking at things, looking at the whole picture, it's tough to say it's tough to make the argument that the world would be better off if the churches were empty. Because, I mean, there is a lot of good that comes from it. It's just tough for my personal experience and what I've seen, kind of the false hope that I've seen given in it, right, in faith. It's tough for me to not say just fucking burn them all down, you know.
I metaphorically did that. I was teaching art history out at AWC for a couple of years. And, you know, you can't teach art history and not discuss religion because so much, if you follow the money at least, I mean, the Renaissance was defined by religion. Most art has been, up to the 20th century, has been defined as some sort of religious practice, for lack of a, you know, it's actually the expression of an altered state of consciousness, but that's what religion is anyway.
Yeah.
It's made some beautiful things. I guess if the end justifies the means, I mean, I used to rebel against it in terms of I'm being lied to. I knew early on I was being lied to at church every moment, you know, and I have a certain resentment from that I'm going to carry for the rest of my life. I mean, it messed me up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, because you're basically living a lie. And you're not going to have a very good conversation if you're basing your conversation on a falsehood.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, that was... My outs with religion, like my true outs, all stem from, I mean, from the pain of what it caused. You know, my parents raised me in a religious home. Bible studies every Saturday morning, church every Sunday morning, church every Wednesday night. Volunteering, I mean, and they taught me all of these core beliefs that were founded from the Bible. Their marriage was rock steady because of God. You know, all of the morals that we had and that we followed came from the Bible. And then comes the day that, you know, Dad just up and forgets and decides, fuck all those morals, fuck, you know, everything that I taught you.
It's a house of cards.
Exactly. I don't want to abide by them right now, so I'm going to, you know, do this. I'm going to take off. Adios. Do your thing. I'm not happy.
But God will forgive me later. Exactly. So.
And that was the most vivid part of it all, and I think that the most painful part of it all was literally hearing just my mom be broken after 25 years of marriage, of putting and doing everything for him and for God, just sitting there in bed, screaming and crying and in pain, saying, you know, God, how could you do this to me? How did this happen? And then hearing her say, you know what, God's going to work it all out.
And they hang on to it.
They hang on.
They hang on to it.
And that was the worst part, is I wanted nothing more than to just tell her, you need to set yourself free. You have this chain on yourself that is that God's going to work all of this shit out, and it's weighing you down.
Well, that for me is what it was that sense of freedom.
Yeah.
A lot of people look at it as an existential, it's terror management.
Yeah.
You know, life is short, it's brutish, and then we die. That is an unacceptable proposition for human beings.
Yeah.
We do not operate well historically. That doesn't work. You know, I need a belief in reincarnation. I'm going to see the Buddha and he's going to send me back. Because, you know, all these very strange sort of configurations of thought that are very complex, very intricate, incredibly powerful. And even to this day, in the shadow of the scientific revolution, they hold.
Yeah.
It holds.
It's, I mean, we made a joke about it, I think just this morning. I mean, they did the cogs and, you know, it's a well-oiled machine, religion is, because it backs itself up at every point.
How can you not, when the whole scandal in the Catholic Church broke,
how does that not shatter your
how
your
does
belief?
It why don't they nobody's burning those places to the ground.
I know, no one's fucking killing those priests for raping their kids for years. I mean, it's no one's, I mean, so many people are just shutting their mouth about it. They don't, it doesn't faze them, you know, and that's it's just unbelievable. I know that there were some people whose faith was rocked, but
They bounced back.
Yeah.
I bet they went right back in there.
And you know where they went to when they were hurting? They went to the church.
Yeah.
And the church said, don't let this rock your faith. God wouldn't want you to lose your faith. And that's what the problem is with me, is that I see these people trapped in something that is just a fucking circle, you know? Pain, God did it. Anything good, you know, or something bad happened, the devil did it. Something good happened, you know, God did it. Something bad happened, then either the devil did it, or maybe God, you know, everything happens for a reason. I love when people ask me, do you believe everything happens for a reason?
No.
Fuck no.
No.
I believe everything
happens for a reason.
Because it can happen.
Right.
That is the only reason something happens, because it's one of the many possibilities of things happening.
You assign reason after the fact.
Yeah, like
you have to make sense out of some phenomenon, because you're in a constant state of making a deal with nature.
Yeah,
that's what superstition is. That's the earliest art, was pictures of sacrifices to the gods. Mesopotamia, Egypt, they would have these elaborate feasts to give to the gods, because it's like, please, let's not have our luck be broken here.
Yeah, in the And the saddest thing, I mean, is that, like, in the situation with my parents, I mean, my mom really, truly believes that all of that happened so that she could make a movie about my parents' relationship. That was why God did it, so that they could make a movie about everything that's happened in their relationship, and it'd have a great story.
What if that's not wrong? What proof do you have that that's wrong?
That is fucking... That I think it happened because he was just ready for some other pussy, you know? Like, I mean... Well,
clearly.
Yeah.
But that's kind of short-sighted, Levi. You know, if you... I mean, I understand what you're saying. And I don't mean to trivialize that level of pain and suffering. But you can't see the forest with all the trees in the way. You know what I mean? There's cogs. Like, the illusion you go to, the illustration you go to is, you know, I don't see the cog down the road, how it's going to turn. But my thing is, I don't think that I'm turning a cog at all. I think I'm being turned. I think that I'm as instinctual a reactor as the dog or a flower turning toward the sunshine. Yeah. We think we're outside of nature when we are nature. And we have what happened in human consciousness, my idea, or ideas I read about or heard about or watched YouTube videos about, is the idea that we're acting in a cause and effect relationships that are infinitely complex, very hard for us to track, but are nonetheless outside of free will. I think free will is an illusion.
Yeah.
Completely. It's all instinctual.
One of the easiest ways, I mean, to really make you question free will, I mean, I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but if you've ever had a similar reaction to a situation as you've seen someone else have, mm-hmm. such as a parent or something, you see, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you drop this or, you know, someone says this or, you know, this happens and you do the same thing. And you're like, I swore that was my reaction. That was not something I picked up on at.
Levi, every Monday morning, I got in my car and I thought, if I turn left instead of right, I'm going to drive to the ocean and figure out what happens next. Because I'm really not. I think I was happier and better at what I did than I understood at the time.
Yeah.
But in my mind, I wanted to be painting. I didn't want to go teach school. That was something I, quote, had to do. Well, actually, I did have to do it. Yeah. I think I made a choice every Monday morning. I didn't have a choice. My instinct was to go to that school every Monday morning. And it's the same thing as being a parent. I've talked to other parents, and they think that they're helping make their kids better human beings and well-adjusted human beings because of the choices they're making. You're not making a choice. There's no morning I would ever get up and beat my kid. Yeah. That was not a choice. I was going to do the best thing I could by my kid by instinct, not by will. It was not an act of will. But the great human delusion is that I am imposing something. I'm authoring something. I'm just playing out the Matrix.
Yeah, and I mean, something I had a discussion with America about recently, that was the only things, the only decision we ever make in our life, and for every situation, is what we truly want to do. Because if I truly wanted to stay at work and finish up that deal right now, more than I wanted to be here, I would have been at work. You know, even in situations where you think, fuck, do I really have to go to this wedding with you? Do I have to? I really don't want to fucking do my taxes. I don't want to walk the dog. I don't want to, you know, or you think, I'm just doing this for this other person so that they're happy. At the end of the day, it all stems down to what you truly want, which is, I mean, you making the right-hand turn going to work every Monday morning.
So you do see it as a choice. You're making a choice.
I see it. I get why you would say that, but no. Because I think that me saying that you doing what you truly want to do is your instinct.
Yeah.
It's you really don't have a choice. Oh. Because you're always going to do the option that you would rather be doing.
Right.
Because I could always just fucking, you know, go exact like you said, make a left and go to the beach. I could easily do that right now. And I would love that. I would love to just get away for a day, maybe go spend some time. I mean, but are me and America really going to go do it?
You don't want to suffer the consequences of that decision.
Exactly. So
it's a binary choice.
We're just think, you know, and I'm not sitting here analyzing what are the what would happen if I were to, you know, just take off and move to Mexico and never come back.
Right.
As you know, interesting as that might be, I'm not sitting here really analyzing all these decisions. I'm just not fucking making them.
I've been told more than once that I overthink, but I think David Bowie said that the only difference between artists and other people is artists dwell on things, and I have like things I dwell on.
And that's one thing I want to ask you about as well. I mean, is your art has when you started getting into art? I mean, or at least kind of give me some backstory on that, because is it. Would you consider yourself born an artist, or did it come from a place of need that you needed somewhere like that? Or?
It was definitely from a place of need. I was never the best artist, quote unquote, whatever that means, in a class. There was always somebody who could look at something and copy what they saw more accurately, according to your retina, than I could. Yeah. I was never that guy. But what I recognized was, I remember an elementary art teacher Van Gogh or Michelangelo or somebody, and it just hit me at that time that these people live forever. That Van Gogh painting is 100 and, I don't know how long, 1870, 1880, however long ago that was. That idea is alive today. And that goes back to the value of religion in comforting human beings and helping them cope with their terror, is the idea that that's an opportunity for immortality. And that I grasped, I understood.
Mm-hmm. And that's what you... You know,
I'm still grasping at it.
And that's what you, I mean, you want, that's what you want to get out of all, I mean, that's your number one, you know, reason. I mean, that's why, I mean, and I was really interested when Saul asked you if he could paint over your paintings. Ooh, after you. That was, wow. I couldn't believe
he's
that.
He's never gone down that road.
Yeah. That was an instant. That was an instant. You said, and I quote, you said, no, I can't quote. We're a little tipsy.
We were a lot tipsy.
I think you either said something like, no, Saul, this is my legacy.
Yes, that's exactly what I said.
Which I find funny that you're saying that to your son.
Well, they don't, it's like, we took him to art openings and we're looking at him going, this is cool. Mom and dad have art on the wall. Isn't that cool? And he's like, God, can I just go home?
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't mean anything to them. It doesn't, you know, there's no, again, they're too close to see it, I guess. Or maybe it really is shit. I don't know. One of the two. He probably, maybe he looks at it and thinks he can improve it, because that's the way I'm thinking. It's like, no, yeah. Dude, it took me 45 years of dabbling at this to get to this moment in this spot.
I thought it was a ballsy question. I truly did. For him
it
to
was.
Ask,
it was a gutsy question.
Post-mortem, do you mind if I just...
Certain things I probably wouldn't have a problem with, but there are other things that might not look complete to him or look like they're in a good spot for he knows exactly what to do with it. That I would just assume, you know, whatever, man. You never know.
Yeah.
You never know.
I think that the worst thing would be him misinterpreting what your reasoning was behind something, and then it's still your legacy.
Yeah. You know? That's what I'm really trying to work out, is what the meaning is behind it. Because I don't paint to tell you what I know. I paint to find out what I don't know. And each painting is a dot on a course. And the value of that course is yet to be determined. Because that's why people, Van Gogh and these people, most artists don't really know what their legacy is at their time. Because time takes time. And there's no... All you can do is just put it out there, and whatever happens, happens.
And that's the fucked up part. I mean, what if we truly could understand what our legacy was at the time? I mean, would we feel more value, more intrinsic happiness overall? I mean, if we really understood that we were doing something that was gonna keep us alive for generations. I mean, would you?
That's narcissistic and egotistical, and I think probably, but I don't think it would last. I've sold paintings, I've won awards, I've had shows, and none of that lasts. It lasts for like 2 days, and then it's like, I just want to get back to work.
What's the most gratifying moment of your entire painting career?
Looking at an individual work and just feeling this click in my head. Yeah. There's a spot in my brain I'm trying to hit, and if I can do that with a painting, it usually means something, I wasn't in it, something else was in it, I didn't do it. The paintings I did are not good. They're pretty flat. But the things that are like coming from somewhere else, that moment, that's gratifying. And I've had people buy paintings that didn't know me. See, a lot of people in this, most artists who sell during their lifetime have pretty good hustle. I got no hustle. People get asked, tell me about this painting in gallery shows. I have no idea what to tell them.
Yeah.
I have no clue what to say. A lot of friends and associates, they got that wrapped down. And I, you know, it's gratifying when somebody just looks at a painting and they don't know who I am, never met me. It's not a postcard of this fellow. It's, no, this is a good painting based on their experience of what painting is. That's a good feeling.
When I have a favor, when we have 2 minutes left. Can you give us a reminder instead? Thank you.
We got five right now.
Okay. Well,
the producer just talked. She said she was going to talk.
She said, cut these guys off.
I asked her if I could have a beer, and she said no.
So then I wanted to ask you, I mean, because one of your first questions was, you know, you taught 6,000 students.
I did.
And what about it stuck? I mean, you've met 6,000 students.
I'm as the luckiest.
What about it, you know, for me? Why does this work for you as well?
It's the most human of all activities. I never liked titles. I never liked names. Father, husband, teacher. I never felt, I don't know what it is, it's just low self-esteem. I never felt up to any of those jobs. And then I look around, I'm thinking, wait a minute, somehow or other I pulled that off. And then when I run into people in restaurants that are adults that I had in my class years earlier, in some cases now decades earlier, and say, Mr. Jones, we loved your class, it was great. It was like, that feels really good.
Yeah.
It feels really good. And again, that feels like it's beyond me. That wasn't something I sat down and decided to do. Being a teacher was something I did as a path of least resistance. My parents were not going to let me stay in my bedroom and paint. They said, you need to either get a job or go to college. Going to college sounded easier. You need to get a job in graphic design or teaching. Teaching sounded easier. I have never had a plan. Never. Clueless. I'm just wandering around.
Yeah, just trying to figure... Just trying to make something out of it.
Yeah,
you
know? I got really lucky. Incredibly lucky.
We discussed this. Yeah,
yeah. You were like, I'm a walking lottery ticket. Yeah, I am.
I mean, and I think that kind of adds. I think that adds so much to your story. Whereas a lot of people would, you know, would just destroy themselves. I think it's great in your story because it's like, in because how you look at it, you don't look at it as like, look at what I came about. Look at what happened to me. You say, holy shit.
I don't.
Can you believe after my life and everything I've done I'm this guy?
No, I'm a walking ball of doubt. I always have been. And I think that's a good thing. I think people who strive are always questioning. They're never complacent. They're never satisfied. You sold 3 cars last month. Why didn't I sell 5? That's always in the back of your mind, right?
Always. I mean, I talked with a finance manager at my work today. He showed me his check for $13,200. He said, fuck, man. I was hoping to make 15.
That's the human condition.
I mean,
that's the way it is, man.
I was hoping to make... I was like, I literally told him, you son of a bitch. You made 13 grand on this check.
You're president of the United States, but you need to build a hotel in Moscow.
Yeah.
That's the real goal here. You need to build an empire in Moscow. That's what we're trying to do.
And that's that's the enjoyable part about talking with people is because, I mean, the more people that you talk to, the more that you realize we're all just looking around trying to make something out of nothing, you know?
Yeah.
Trying to really make it happen, you know? Yeah. Find happiness or fulfillment or be content or... Whatever it is, I mean, we're all just searching for something at this point.
I guess. Is it?
I think so.
Or just,
I mean,
most
truly.
People just like don't want to think about it, right?
And at,
they just
I
don't
mean,
want to be bothered with it.
And at the end, even you, I mean, you spend a lot of time painting. That's, I mean, that would be the majority of, I would say right now, you're kind of your focus, where you're putting
absolutely
your efforts.
Absolutely it is. And, I mean, I'm trying to maintain a family, too, and I'm being very successful.
Yeah, you are. Oh, for sure. Know. Yeah. But, you know, you're just searching for a legacy. You're trying to create a legacy.
I am.
And even though you don't, you know, you would really don't wake up and think about, how the fuck am I going to make a legacy today? It's something that you're just intrinsically looking for.
What I really need, I have, and that's license. All I need is permission.
Yeah.
That's all you as a human being need is enough room to manifest whatever it is that you have to manifest. And I've got that. The idea that anybody else would give a crap what I'm painting is a luxury.
And I give a crap. Definitely.
I can't tell you how much your friendship means to me.
Same to you. I mean, we've been shared more with you than anyone I know, honestly.
That's a sacred trust, man.
Of course.
I take it that way. Thanks, Levi.
Appreciate it, Scott.
All right, man. All right. That's for you, Steven. Skeep.